Retail sales are up by the biggest amount in 7 months.
But retailers say people aren't buying the really expensive stuff.
Marketplace Morning Report is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From American Public Media, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It's Monday, November 15th. Coming up, is the world of free email about to change? Plus, we'll tell you about a strange new relaxation technique.
But first, retail sales rose in October by the biggest percentage since March. That's news this morning from the Commerce Department. Let's get reaction now from Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. She joins us from London. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Julia, sales up by 1.2%. It's the biggest rise since March. Is retail back?
Well, I would caution taking too much optimism from the numbers. Part of it is inflation. So gas prices rose quite a bit, pushing up the numbers. Now, consumers did spend on cars, and that's a good sign, but they also pulled back on spending on electronics and department stores. So overall, it's still a mixed picture, and I'd say consumers are still pretty cautious on how they allocate those dollars.
Okay, we got earnings this morning from the big home improvement chain Lowe's. They missed expectations, and they say the reason why is because people are putting off big home renovations that are very expensive. Put that into context of the retail sales this morning.
Well, that really does highlight the trends that we've been seeing in retail sales, which is that consumers are willing to spend on smaller ticket items like clothing and restaurant meals, but they've really shied away and been very conservative about spending on autos or renovation projects and the kinds of items that usually require a deeper sense of optimism about the future. So I'd say consumers are still pretty cautious, and retailers are feeling it.
Okay, Julia Coronado, chief economist at the investment bank BNP Paribas. Thanks, as always, for your time.
It's my pleasure.
A big deal to tell you about this morning. Caterpillar is going to buy the mining company Bucyrus for more than $7 billion. Now, you can expect a lot more deals this week. It's expected to be the biggest week of initial public offerings since 2008. General Motors will reportedly go through its IPO on Thursday. That'll mean taxpayers will get some of their money back from the government's rescue. In China, state media reports the car maker SAIC Motor, that's a Chinese company, has agreed to buy a big stake in GM. The BBC's Chris Hogg is with us now from Shanghai with the latest. Hi, Chris.
Hello.
Why would the Chinese be interested in buying a stake in GM?
Well, this is coming from unnamed sources. SAIC isn't commenting today, but China might be the biggest auto market in the world this year, but the US market is still the most profitable. This is likely an attempt by SAIC to strengthen its ties with the US automaker. Now, although some in the US may be uncomfortable with the idea that the Chinese are buying a stake in GM, GM is an international company that has to do business on a global basis, analysts say. The US Treasury, of course, has been clear that the international investors are welcome to invest in GM.
Hey, Chris, how important is SAIC to GM's success in China?
It's vital. GM couldn't sell cars in China without partnering with a local business. Now, this deal will need Chinese government approval if it goes through, but the Chinese government ties with SAIC are very close indeed, so that shouldn't be a problem. GM said earlier this month that it had become the first international car maker to sell 2 million vehicles in a year in China. So this close relationship between these two companies is very important for both of them.
The BBC's Chris Hogg in Shanghai. Chris, thanks.
Thank you.
Congress gets back to work today, and topping the agenda is the fate of the Bush tax cuts that expire at the end of the year. The Obama administration says it's for extending the middle class cuts, and it indicated over the weekend a possible compromise on those tax cuts that affect the wealthiest Americans. But there's another tax break that runs out soon that you probably haven't heard much about. It was included in the big stimulus package that passed in 2009. So, did it work? Here's Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer.
The White House thought people would spend the extra money if they didn't know about it. 95% of us just had less tax taken out of our paychecks, about $65 a month for families. But University of Michigan economist Joel Slemrod says most of us saved the money or paid down debt. He asked about 1,000 taxpayers what they do with the stealth cash. Only 13% said they would spend it. Slemrod says most people are like him, on a budget, and the recession hasn't helped encourage spending. Only a separate tax rebate check would make him a big spender.
If I got a check in the mail, it might convince me to splurge on a nice dinner with my wife.
But Chuck Marr at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says Slemrod is only looking at upper-income taxpayers.
Middle-class, working-class people live paycheck to paycheck. If their paychecks are larger, they're going to spend more.
Marr says if Congress lets the stealth tax cut expire, those workers' paychecks will shrink and they'll spend less. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The Federal Reserve has begun pumping money into the U.S. economy, saying that that's going to bring down long-term interest rates. But other countries claim the U.S. is simply adding to turmoil in the currency markets. Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan says it's yet another example of the U.S. economy not holding the clout it once did. Good morning, Alan.
Good morning, Steve.
How did the U.S. get into this position?
Well, the U.S. messed up its economy by having a bunch of bubbles. It's overborrowed from the rest of the world. And now, instead of being a huge creditor nation, it's becoming dependent on everybody. And that's a weak position to be in.
Does the Federal Reserve have the same global economic clout that it once had?
Alas, it doesn't. It's in the same position as the country because as the U.S. has declined relative to the rest of the world, so has the Fed. And we're used in this country to thinking of it as all-powerful, and it's not even remotely all-powerful.
Is it because, Alan, of the downtrodden U.S. economy that the Fed is weaker, or is it the other way around? Chicken or egg here, Alan?
Well, it's a little bit of both. I think we could call it a chegg, where part of the problem is the Fed lowered short-term interest rates to zero to bail out the U.S. economy and the world financial system. But the U.S. economy is still weak, so the Fed is inventing all of these things, including this stuff called quantitative easing that is not going down well in the rest of the world because it's debasing the American currency and running up the price of commodities.
Who's getting stronger, Alan, because of the Fed's weakness and because of the American weakness?
Well, collectively, the rest of the world is getting stronger relative to the United States. If I had to pick winners, and this were a sports show, which I guess to some extent I have to do,
yeah.
I would pick China, I would pick Germany, though I'd want to come back in 5 years and see if they were still winning.
Will the economy, the U.S. economy, Alan, ever get its luster back? And when I say that, I mean the Fed as well?
Absolutely. The United States economy will get better and will be lustrous. The Fed will get some of its luster back, but both of them, you have to think of them as like aging ball players. They're still pretty good, but they're not what they were and they're never going to be.
You and your sports metaphors. Fortune magazine's Alan Sloan. Alan, thanks.
You're welcome, Steve.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, the 15th of November. I'm Steve Chiotakis. For the latest look at the markets, check out the numbers. That's at our website, marketplace.org.
Time now for the global perspective, what's happening in business and economics around the world and how it affects us here in the United States.
Ireland says it's in talks with other European governments about its economic problems, but the Irish government claims it is not negotiating a bailout. Reports are Ireland could need $110 billion to avoid economic collapse. The country is in a debt crisis, and if Ireland can't pay those debts, well, it could deal a blow to global markets and banks all over the world. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London to talk about it. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So Ireland seems pretty adamant that it doesn't need this bailout. Why are they saying that?
Well, the government in Dublin says it can pay its bills. It's not running out of cash. And Jan Randolph of IHS Global Insight agrees.
The Irish government, of all the Eurozone governments, is almost fully funded. And they've got sufficient means to finance themselves until June next year. So that until then, they don't need the money.
And there's national pride at stake. The trade and business minister says Ireland must show it can stand alone. He says, we struggled long and hard for independence. We're not going to surrender that independence.
The question, all right, of independence, is that a big a deal?
Well, the Irish seem to fear that their independence, or rather their freedom to set their own policies, could be at stake. There were reports here over the weekend that behind the scenes, the French and the Germans are insisting on a quid pro quo for any Irish bailout, that Ireland would be forced to raise its corporation tax rates. The French and the Germans feel that Ireland's very low business taxes give it an unfair advantage in Europe in attracting foreign investment. The Irish, however, are determined to keep their low rates. That's how they attracted major corporations like Intel, Dell and Pfizer to set up in Ireland. It's one of the main pillars of Irish prosperity.
All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
Steve, you mentioned earlier that a Chinese automaker is expected to be a big buyer of GM shares on Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's no surprise to Patrick Fowles, banking editor at The Economist magazine. He's just written the cover story about a coming wave of Chinese takeovers, and he joins us now. Patrick Fowles, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So in the latest issue of The Economist, you write that China's share of the world's foreign direct investment is rising very quickly. How fast is it rising?
This year so far, China's accounted for about 10% of global deals. So we expect that number to move up quite sharply this year. And over the long term, it could move up a lot.
And meanwhile, other countries' shares, I assume, are dropping.
Yeah. So if you look at America, for example, the U.S. owned about half of the world's foreign direct investment in the late 1960s, and that's already dropped very sharply into the sort of 20 to 30% range. So we expect that trend to continue with emerging economies going up and China in particular getting a lot bigger.
And what's the effect of all of this?
One effect is political controversy. As we outlined in our article, many of the Chinese companies are directed by the government in some form. So I think that will continue to create trade frictions. The other element is obviously that it's another way for China's excess savings to find a way into Western investment. And at the moment, a lot of their investment is put into U.S. government bonds.
And you write in the article that there are a lot of questions about how ready China is to manage some of these companies.
Well, that's right. We spoke to just over 10 firms anonymously that had been bought by Chinese businesses. And the picture we got was that although they were often very good technically, for example, at mining or the geology of oil, for example, their ability to manage foreigners was limited. And that comes back to the idea that often the most successful international companies are those which sort of transcend their nationality. And if that's true, China still has a long way to go.
Patrick Fowles, banking editor of The Economist, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
New technology and climate change have made it easier to drill for oil deep off the icy coast of Greenland. The country's planning to award permits to oil companies soon, but it wants something from those companies first. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Eve Tro reports.
A dozen oil companies applied to drill off of Greenland. BP was one of them, but it pulled out after the Gulf of Mexico spill. And that spill got Greenland thinking. We need to protect ourselves from foreign oil companies.
And if they have an accident and go away, it may be difficult for Greenland to come after them.
That's energy economist Gilbert Metcalf. Any company that gets a license in Greenland now has to put up $2 billion to pay for cleanup if there's an accident. That's a first, says Metcalf. And Greenland is risky.
You've got winds over 200 miles an hour up there. Iceberg Alley, a risk for ships that are taking oil out of the area as well as the rigs.
The fee isn't likely to scare off oil companies, says economist Phil Verleger, though it might change how much of the profits they're willing to share.
Companies may offer a lower royalty if Greenland's going to hold on to that $2 billion.
Those companies need years just to prepare to drill, and Greenland will hold on to all that money in the meantime. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
Listening to the Midday Update for Monday, November 15th. I'm Steve Chiotakis in Los Angeles.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York. For the latest look at the markets, you can go to the numbers at marketplace.org. Well, all this week, entrepreneurs around the world are huddling together, making stuff up. Ideas, inventions, maybe even a few startups. It's called Global Entrepreneurship Week. More than 100 countries will hold youth gatherings, contests, and university forums. As Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports from our entrepreneurship desk at Oregon Public Broadcasting, the U.S. is facing ever greater competition from entrepreneurs abroad, especially in Asia.
An analysis by Bloomberg found that Asian companies will garner two-thirds of the capital from initial public offerings this year. U.S. companies will get just about 10%. A decade ago, U.S. IPOs were way out in front, and companies in Asia weren't ready to go public.
5 or 6 years ago, I was not impressed with what I saw.
That's Berkeley researcher Vivek Wadhwa, and I reached him in Bangalore, India. He'd just been teaching entrepreneurs in Malaysia and was on his way to China.
Today, I'm absolutely, completely blown away by the energy, by the enthusiasm, and by the quality of companies that I'm seeing in both India and China. Move forward 5 years, these countries will dwarf the United States in terms of innovation and entrepreneurship.
Asian companies are already raising a lot of money to grow from investors in Asia and the U.S. Emily Mendel of the National Venture Capital Association explains where that leads.
Increasing interest in investing in China, investing in Asia. The results of that won't be seen for some time because, again, a venture capital investment is typically 5 to 10 years.
Mendel says Asian governments have changed tax laws and regulations to make investment more attractive. Vivek Wadhwa says they're also starting to crack down on graft and bureaucracy.
The Indian and Chinese governments, even though they're corrupt, they know that their future lies in allowing this entrepreneurship and allowing the innovation to happen.
That same energy is spilling over into the U.S., says Robert Lighton of the Kauffman Foundation.
Roughly one quarter of our successful high-tech companies have been founded or co-founded by immigrants over the last decade.
Lighton wants the U.S. to grab even more of that startup spirit.
And so if I could wave a magic wand, all those foreign immigrants that are now at American universities, I would give them a green card as soon as they graduate and let them stay here, because we know disproportionately they will found new firms and create more jobs.
Lighton supports a new entrepreneur's visa for immigrants who start a business and employ someone other than a family member. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Lots of internet email news to tell you about today. AOL has announced Project Phoenix, the long-awaited overhaul of its email, and Facebook is expected to announce an email service of its own, which some are calling the Gmail killer. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith joins me now here in New York to sort through all these domain names. Good morning, Stacey.
Good morning, Jeremy.
So AOL announced yesterday a new email service. Why did they roll this out last night?
Well, basically, as you said, it was all about Facebook. Hmm. Facebook is expected to announce its own email service a bit later this morning. And that's actually the real news here, because these days the business of email is not actually about email. I spoke with NetTech's Steve Kennedy about this. Here was his take.
Doing email is nothing to do with actually providing an email service. It's providing an advertising platform.
Email services can now mine your emails, and they show you ads based on what you're talking about. Facebook already has tons of information on us, so all of that together would be an advertising goldmine.
And now, why is Facebook's email service already being called the Gmail killer?
Yes. Well, Facebook already has 500 million users, and if all of those users start using Facebook email, it would make Facebook the biggest email provider in the world by far, more than double the size of Gmail.
Huh.
But Duke University's Ken Wilber thinks this actually might be kind of a dangerous move for Facebook.
If you talk to college students, for them, email is, you know, for people over 30. It's like, don't trust anyone with an email account.
And Wilber points out that having an older people image is part of the problem AOL has now.
I think a lot of us feel a lot older right now. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith, thanks so much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Steve, what do you think a reasonable number of friends is?
Let me think here, Jeremy. 2,200.
2,200. That would be a very popular person on Facebook. Yeah. I mean, usually you see people with like 100 or 200 or even 1,000 friends on Facebook. Well, the creators of a new social network called Path think that 50 is the appropriate amount.
Wow.
So that's the maximum number of friends that you can have on Path.
What happens, though, Jeremy, if you go past 50? I mean, do they like come in, like, lob off your hand or something like that?
I mean, they probably have some kind of control. There's some limit on 50. But the thing is, you're going to have a lot more enemies than that, it seems like, if you you have to limit them to 50. Why didn't I make it into your Path friends?
It's like the top 50 list, right?
That's right.
Yeah. Oh, boy. Finally, some researchers, Jeremy, in Canada say, and you can relate to this as well, men are more relaxed when they see cooked red meat. Do you get more relaxed?
I think actually that could be true. I feel like if I see a nice steak on the table, I might be a little more relaxed.
But it's more about smelling it, right?
Oh.
There's nothing like the smell of a good steak, unless you're, of course, vegetarian. Scientists at McGill University say it could date back to early humans hunting and gathering, and then happily eating their catch with their families all together. Isn't that nice?
I wonder how they found that out.
I don't know. How did they go back in time that far? Maybe
some interviews from the past.
The flux, what was it, the capacitor?
Flux capacitor.
Flux capacitor,
exactly.
Yeah. That was obviously, though, I can tell you, going back to the hunting and gathering days, everybody was all happy. That was before the in-laws started coming over.
Oh, the in-laws.
Something that happens. Yeah.
All right. Well, in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.